Lesson number 18 in the series of Old Testament survey over the last half of 1 Kings. In preparation, read 1 Kings chapter 11, verses 26 through 42, and then chapters 12, 17, 18, 19, and 21. We started the book of 1 Kings in lesson 15, but we only studied the life of Solomon and then stopped to look at the three books that he wrote: Song of Songs, Proverbs, and Ecclesiastes. Now, we are back in 1 Kings to study the rest of the book. Chapters 1 through 11 were about the reign of Solomon. Chapters 12 through 16 are about the division of the kingdom, while chapters 17 through 22 tell about the ministry of Elijah. Up to this point, there have only been three kings over the nation of Israel: Saul, David, and Solomon. When Saul was appointed king, he was immediately accepted by all 12 tribes or family clans. When David became king, only his family tribe of Judah accepted him. The other 11 wanted to continue with Saul's family. But after 7 years, all the nation accepted him. However, 10 of those tribes still had reservations. They did not like the idea that all future kings would only come from David's family and the tribe of Judah, so they demanded that David sign an agreement. Every time a new king came to power, he would have to go north and meet with these 10 tribes. They would then decide to accept or reject him. As we would say today, they wanted an opt-out clause from always being under a king from the line of David. After 40 years of being king, David died. His son Solomon was declared king in the south. Following the agreement, he then went north and got the approval of the 10 tribes. They immediately accepted him. After 40 years as king over all the nation, Solomon died. Now his son Rehoboam is named king by the 2 tribes of the south. In chapter 14, verse 21, we are told he's 41 years old. However, this is one of those cases where a number was copied incorrectly. All scholars agree it should say Rehoboam is 21. Remembering the agreement made by his grandfather David, Rehoboam travels north to get the approval of the other 10 tribes. According to chapter 12, verse 4, they say they will accept him on 2 conditions: that he lower the taxes and not force them into slave labor. Being young and inexperienced, Rehoboam is not sure if he should accept or refuse these conditions. He tells them he needs 3 days to think about it. At 21 years old, Rehoboam has to decide what kind of king he will be: harsh or compassionate. It is significant he does not ask God what he should do. Instead, he goes first to his father's counselors. Then he turns to his boyhood friends, who are now serving as his advisors. They are referred to as young men, which is evidence that Rehoboam is also young. This is one of the reasons we know his age is 21. As you might imagine, the advice of other 20-year-olds is not going to be very mature or wise. After listening to both his father's and his own advisors, he follows the suggestions of his peers. In chapter 12, verse 13, Rehoboam tells the 10 tribes, "If you thought it was bad under my father, it's going to be even worse under me. Instead of less, there is now going to be more labor and more taxes. My father scourged you with whips. I will scourge you with scorpions." A scorpion was a type of whip that caused more pain and physical suffering than the usual whip. In other words, Rehoboam plans to be more severe than his father, not only in taxes and forced labor, but even in his punishment. Rehoboam thinks the 10 tribes will be impressed with his use of force and power. But instead, they only see his immaturity and arrogance. If you think back on the life of Solomon, when he became king at 20, he had humility and dependence on God. When God offered him anything he wanted, he said, "God, I need wisdom, for who is able to govern this great people of yours?" Solomon's humility and dependence on God came from the training of his godly parents, David and Bathsheba. Rehoboam, now at 21, is exactly the opposite, arrogant and no turning to God. The reason is he had no godly training. His mother was one of Solomon's pagan wives. He grew up during the 10 to 15 years when Solomon was into idolatry. Solomon repented in the last year of his life. He was completely forgiven, meaning his relationship with God was restored. But there were lasting consequences on his son. I point this out because God will always forgive us when we admit our sin and ask his forgiveness. But God does not always remove the consequences. If we willfully disobey God, there will be lasting effects in our lives or in the lives of others. Because of Rehoboam's arrogance, the 10 tribes in the north form their own nation. So from now on, instead of one nation of Israel with the capital in Jerusalem, there will be 2 nations, 2 kings, 2 capitals. There is civil war. Never again in Bible history will there be a united kingdom with the 12 complete tribes. Since the 10 tribes in the north are the majority, they use the original name Israel. Sometimes they will be called Ephraim, the name of the largest tribe. They pick as their king a popular official who worked under Solomon. His name is Jeroboam. At first, there's no permanent capital, but after 45 years, it is set up in Samaria. In the south are the 2 remaining tribes who stay with Solomon's son Rehoboam. Because Benjamin is such a small tribe and Judah is so large, the southern nation will be called Judah. Its capital continues to be in Jerusalem. Jeroboam and Rehoboam. Because the names of the 2 kings are so similar, it can be confusing. However, by using our alphabet, we can remember which belongs where. The letter I in our alphabet is followed by J. I stands for Israel in the north. J for her first king, Jeroboam. Keep the letters I and J together to remember Israel and her first king, Jeroboam. Another problem is how to remember which of the 2 is Solomon's son, Jeroboam or Rehoboam. Once again, the alphabet is helpful. R stands for royal, the royal line of David and Solomon. Rehoboam continues the royal line, which is also the family line of Jesus. So, with the beginning of the civil war and a divided kingdom, Jeroboam is the first king of the northern nation of Israel, and Rehoboam the first king over the southern nation of Judah. There are 2 major differences between these kingdoms. The first is their rulership. In the northern nation of Israel, the kings will come from 9 different family lines. The kings will be decided by coups and revolutions. In the southern nation of Judah, the kings will come from just 1 family line, the line of David. The 2nd difference between the 2 kingdoms is how long they lasted. Israel to the north continued for 208 years. Then a country conquered them and sent the 10 tribes into exile. Some people have called them the 10 lost tribes. I can assure you, they were never lost. They were relocated. Throughout history, everyone has always known who they were and where they were. As a unit, they never came back to Israel. However, throughout the years, families from the 10 tribes did move back to the land. Judah to the south continued for 344 years. Then she was sent into exile by her enemies. However, after a period of just 70 years, thousands returned to the land as a unit and reestablished their identity and nation. Since they were the only nation, they took back the name of Israel for their land. But as a people, they were called Jews because they were from the tribe of Judah. While none of the 10 tribes ever came back to their land as a complete tribe, by the time of the New Testament, extended families from all 10 tribes had moved back. Going back to the days of Moses, the 12 tribes had always been held together by their faith and worship of Yahweh God. Under David and Solomon, all Jewish men went to Jerusalem 3 times a year to celebrate the Jewish holy days of Passover, Pentecost, and the Feast of Tabernacles. When Jeroboam develops the 10 tribes into a separate nation in the north, he knows this worship in Jerusalem kept the people united. According to 1 Kings chapter 12, verse 27, he now says to himself, "If these, my people, go up to offer sacrifices at the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem, they will again give their allegiance to their Lord Rehoboam, king of Judah. They will kill me and return to King Rehoboam." His concern over losing the people means he has totally forgotten God's promise some 15 years earlier. Through one of the prophets, God had told him that because of Solomon's idolatry, the nation would be divided and he, Jeroboam, would be king over part of Israel. If he followed God, he and his family would continue to rule. So now that he is king, all he needs to do is obey God and depend on God's promises. But instead, Jeroboam makes his own plans. However, the plans he makes to keep the kingdom are the very plans which will cause him to lose the kingdom. Chapter 12, verse 28 describes these plans. To begin, Jeroboam puts a golden calf at both the northern and southern boundaries of his kingdom, in Dan to the north and Bethel in the south. He should know better than to use golden calves to represent Yahweh. In the days of Moses, Aaron had done it, and God sent punishment. But Jeroboam is not thinking of Jewish history. For the past 10 to 15 years, he has been living in Egypt and is thinking of their religion. The golden calves are bad enough, but in chapter 12, verse 31, we read he builds high places, or shrines, among the groves. This means he is creating places for religious prostitution as they worship idols. Then he chooses priests from other than the tribe of Levi in direct disobedience to God's command. Finally, in chapter 12, verse 32, he makes up a new holy day for the people to celebrate during the 8th month. They will not need to go to Jerusalem in the 7th month for the Feast of Tabernacles. What Jeroboam does is create a counterfeit religion. Golden calves in place of worship at the temple, men chosen as priests in place of those from the tribe of Levi, and a new holy day in place of the ones created by God. Jeroboam sets the pattern for all 18 kings who follow him. Throughout the rest of this book and in 2 Kings, we read such and such king followed in the ways of Jeroboam. This means they continue this counterfeit religion. Throughout the entire 208 years, every king in the northern nation of Israel will be evil. The middle chapters of 1 Kings are confusing. They first tell about one or two kings of Israel and what they do. Then it goes back in time to tell about one or two kings of Judah. Just as you are following the story, it shifts back to Israel and then again to Judah. Unless you are familiar with the kings, it is difficult to follow. These lessons will mention only the kings who are associated with the prophets. Jeroboam is the first king in the north. He rules 22 years and then dies. Over the next 24 years, four more kings come to power. This brings us to the sixth king of Israel. He and the king of Sidon make a military agreement. They confirm it with an arranged marriage of their children. Sidon was a city-state on the Mediterranean seacoast in Phoenicia. We know it today as Lebanon. The king of Sidon's daughter is named Jezebel. She is the priestess for their national god Baal Melkart. She is sent to marry the son of Israel's king. The son's name is Ahab. After ruling 12 years, Israel's king dies. As planned, Ahab, his son, becomes king. He is Jewish. Jezebel, his wife, is a Gentile. As queen, she now teaches the Jewish people to worship her god, Baal, the god of fire and fertility. While previous kings were evil, Ahab is even more wicked. But when a nation's sin becomes greater, God's grace becomes more greatly evident. As Ahab and Jezebel lead Israel to greater sin, God sends a special man with special abilities, the prophet Elijah. This brings us to the third part of the outline, the ministry of Elijah. Elijah is a prophet only to Israel in the north. His name means Yahweh is my God. He is convinced that Yahweh is the only God and there is no limit to what God can do. Elijah grieves as he sees the Jews worshiping Baal. Ahab and Jezebel have made it the national religion. So, it is the leaders he wants to reach. If he can get Ahab and Jezebel to follow Yahweh God, the people would also follow God. This is why we first meet Elijah talking with King Ahab. Turn to chapter 17, verse 1. Now Elijah said to Ahab, "As Yahweh, the God of Israel, lives, whom I serve, there will be neither dew nor rain in the next few years except at my word." Notice this phrase, "except at my word," or "until I say so." This sounds egotistical. We would expect Elijah to say, "There will be no rain in the next few years until God says so." To understand Elijah's words, we need to go to the New Testament, to the book of James. It is near the end of the New Testament, James chapter 5, verse 17. Elijah was a man just like us. He prayed earnestly that it would not rain, and it did not rain in the land for 3.5 years. Again he prayed, and the heavens gave rain, and the earth produced its crops. First of all, remember the little phrase, "Elijah was a man just like us." I will refer to it later in the lesson. The verse goes on, "Elijah prayed earnestly that it would not rain." For years, when I read the story in 1 Kings, I assumed God told Elijah it would not rain, and Elijah goes to Ahab merely repeating God's message. But if he is just repeating a message from God, Elijah has nothing to do with it. there would be no need for him to earnestly pray about the rain. So let's look at the story more closely. Elijah is a prophet from God. He knows what God has said in the book of Deuteronomy. God told the Jews if they went into idolatry, he would do a variety of things to get their attention. One of them was to withhold rain until they repented. Elijah believes Yahweh is the one who sends and withholds rain. He knows Ahab, Jezebel, and the people think Baal sends rain to give fertility to the ground. Knowing how God works and how the people think, Elijah prays something like this: God, your people have forgotten you. Ahab and Jezebel have rejected you. So now, based on your words in Deuteronomy, I plead with you, withhold the rain to get their attention. Prove to Ahab and Jezebel that Baal is nothing and you alone are God. After earnestly praying, Elijah believes God will answer. So he goes to Ahab and, in between the lines, is saying, I asked Yahweh to withhold the rain, and I will not ask Yahweh to send it until you and Jezebel repent. There will not be any rain until I say so, until I ask God to send it. God honors Elijah's prayer, and the drought begins. As it takes effect, he is forced to hide in the Kereth Ravine, east of the Jordan River, directly east of Samaria, the capital. According to chapter 17, verse 4, ravens bring him bread and meat twice a day. While at first this may sound like a life of ease, let's take a realistic look. For almost 1 year, Elijah is out in the middle of nowhere, totally alone. He has been used to preaching, working with other prophets, having a ministry, but now there's nothing to do, no one to talk to. There's just Elijah and God for one whole year. So first of all, it is a very lonely, isolated life. Then, as a Jewish man, he's going to find it difficult to accept food from ravens. The law of Moses says ravens are unclean birds, and therefore anything they touch is ceremonially unclean. So from a Jewish point of view, his food is not kosher. But since it is coming from God, he accepts it. However, from a human point of view, there's another issue. Ravens belong to the crow family. They have a powerful body, about 2 feet long with a 3-inch beak. They are a vulture bird. The bread and meat they bring to Elijah are perfectly clean and good, but before they bring it, because they are vultures, they've been sitting on the carcass of some dead animal. Not too pleasant a thought. In other words, this is not an easy time for Elijah. Then, after a year, the brook dries up, and God sends Elijah 60 miles northwest through the land of Israel to the country of Phoenicia. He's to go to the little town of Zarephath along the Mediterranean seacoast. This is a small village 10 miles south of Sidon, Jezebel's hometown. Her father is king not only of Sidon, but also these outlying villages. While Ahab and Jezebel are looking for Elijah to kill him, God hides him in the area controlled by Jezebel's father. Elijah is told to stay in this town, and a widow will supply his food. But Elijah is not given her name, address, or description. As he comes into town, the first person he sees is a woman gathering kindling wood. He knows she is a widow by her clothing. So he does the most obvious. He starts a conversation with her. He asks the widow for water. Since it is a time of drought, she may not want to give him any. But when she agrees, Elijah also asks for some bread. She explains there's only enough flour and oil to make one final meal of bread for herself and her son. After that, they will die of starvation. Elijah says, make me a small amount of bread. Give it to me first, and I promise you in the name of Yahweh, the God of Israel, there will be sufficient flour and oil left for you and your son. But that sounds so selfish. How could a man of God demand the last meal of a widow? Elijah's doing this to find out if she is the widow whom God has provided. She's a Gentile. If she worships Baal, the god of that area, she will not even consider his request. He will then know she is not the right person. However, if she believes in Yahweh, the God of Israel, since the promise has been made in his name, she might respond. The godly influence of David and Solomon in the past had caused many Gentiles in the surrounding areas to become believers and worshipers of Yahweh God. From the story, we discover she is a believer. She demonstrates her faith by giving bread to Elijah first. God honors her faith by providing sufficient flour and oil for the next 2.5 years for her, her son, and for Elijah. While he is with the widow, her son dies. We see Elijah's faith in God's power when we realize Elijah has never read or heard of anyone being raised from the dead. It's never been recorded that God can do it. Yet he takes the boy, prays for God to return his life. God answers Elijah's prayer. This is the first resurrection in the Old Testament. After 2.5 years, God tells Elijah the drought must end, not because Ahab and Jezebel have repented, but because the suffering is so great. So Elijah returns to Israel to talk with the king. He wants the leaders and people to have one more chance to see the difference between Baal and Yahweh God. He tells Ahab to take the prophets of Baal and the people to Mount Carmel. This is the piece of land that juts out along the Mediterranean coast due west of the Sea of Galilee. Because of natural springs in the area, Mount Carmel is considered a holy place, a place of the gods. What a perfect location for a showdown between the gods. When everyone arrives at Mount Carmel, Elijah challenges them. Why are you so undecided on whom to worship? You should give your complete loyalty either to Baal or to Yahweh. Let's build two altars. The prophets can build an altar to Baal. I will build an altar to Yahweh. The God who answers by fire, let him be God. The people agree. This should be easy. After all, Baal is the god of fertility and of fire. The 450 prophets of Baal go first. Although they plead all day, nothing happens. These prophets are totally sincere. But sincerity by itself does not guarantee truth. A person can be totally sincere and be sincerely wrong. For example, I can want to go to the beach here in Oregon via Highway 26 West. But if I have gotten turned around and am heading east on Highway 26, then even though I sincerely believe with all my heart I'm headed for the beach, I will never get there. It's the wrong way. I am sincere, but I am sincerely wrong. It is not sincerity that will get me to the beach. It's making sure I'm on the right road, going in the right direction. You could not find 450 Jewish men more sincere than these prophets of Baal. They plead and beg and slash themselves. However, their sincerity makes no difference. A chunk of wood cannot respond, so there are no results. It is now 3:00 in the afternoon. the time when Jews would begin preparing the evening sacrifice if they were worshiping God. Elijah uses 12 stones to build the altar. He is reminding them that God's original purpose was to have them a united people and nation. If they would follow God, they once again could be 12 tribes under one king. Elijah places the wood and sacrifice on the altar. He then takes 6 gallons of water and soaks everything. This is to prove there's no subterfuge or trick. From secular history, we learn that asking a god to reveal himself by fire was a common way to prove one local deity was more powerful than another. But since idols cannot do anything, it was also common practice for the ones representing their deity to hide fire under the altar. Then, through sleight of hand or trickery, they could give an appearance that fire came from heaven or from their deity. Elijah never wants anybody at any time to wonder whether Yahweh answered or whether it was sleight of hand. But this raises a question. After a 3.5-year drought, where does Elijah get gallons of water to pour over the altar and sacrifice? Earlier I mentioned that because of natural springs, this place is considered holy, a place of the gods. So the water is not available for public use, but it certainly could be used in a challenge between the gods, between Baal, the god of fire, and Yahweh, the god of Israel. After pouring water over the altar, wood, and sacrifice, Elijah prays. Turn to chapter 18, beginning at verse 36. O Yahweh, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, the other name for Jacob, let it be known today that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and have done all these things at your command. Answer me, O Yahweh, answer me, so that these people will know that you, O Yahweh, are God, and that you are turning their hearts back again. Notice how short this prayer is. When we are in right relationship with God, we do not need long prayers to get answers. And do you remember that phrase, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? The God of Abraham, the God who can do the impossible. In this context, he can send fire. The God of Isaac, the God who provides. He can provide rain. The God of Jacob, the one who can change human nature. He can give the people and leaders the desire to worship him. Elijah has led the nation to a choice about God. God answers, and the fire descends. It consumes the sacrifice, wood, stones, dust, and even the water. There can be no doubt it is supernatural fire. With this, the people make their choice. They repent and say, Yahweh is God. However, the prophets of Baal do not respond. So Elijah says, these 450 prophets of Baal are guilty of idolatry. They have not repented. Put them to death according to God's laws. The prophets are killed and Ahab offers no resistance. God told Elijah he was going to send rain, but he did not say when. This is why Elijah prays earnestly that God will send rain now. He wants everyone to see the connection. Their idolatry was the cause of the drought. Their repentance will bring rain. The people leave the mountain. Ahab and Elijah leave, and the rain comes. That night, Elijah is thrilled. The people have repented. Ahab and Jezebel have seen that Baal is just wood and totally helpless. Surely they will also change their minds. The last 3.5 years have been worth it. The next morning, there's a knock on his door. A messenger comes to say Jezebel plans to kill him in the next 24 hours. Jezebel has made her decision. She knows and understands who Yahweh is, but she does not want to change. Elijah makes an important discovery. Just because people have right knowledge and right facts does not guarantee they will make right choices. With this, he becomes very discouraged and deeply depressed. Even though he's a man of great faith, he has human responses. Remember that verse in the book of James? It said he was a man just like us. Elijah heads for the desert 85 miles to the south in the country of Judah. He goes first of all to protect his life, but he also needs to sort out his questions. What went wrong? God showed his power. The choice was so clear. Why did Jezebel reject God? What did I do wrong? Where did I fail? During his time in the desert, God miraculously feeds Elijah and gives him a good rest. These are two practical answers for depression: good food and rest. It is important to notice God never reproves Elijah. He does not ask, "What's wrong with you? Where's your faith?" God just lovingly and tenderly cares for him. With the food and rest, Elijah travels 40 days in the desert. The number 40 in the Bible is always connected with judgment or testing. In this case, it is a test of Elijah's faith. Elijah goes 200 miles further south to Mount Sinai, also known as Mount Horeb. He's going back to square one, to the place where God made the original agreement with the Jews. Elijah had taken God at his word. He prayed earnestly about the rain. God had shown his power, but Ahab and Jezebel did not change. At this point, Elijah is thinking, "My only goal was to bring Ahab and Jezebel to faith in Yahweh God, but they have refused. I'm the only prophet left, and Jezebel's going to kill me. There's nothing more I can do. So God, take my life." God again shows his power to Elijah, this time in wind, earthquake, and fire. But he speaks to him in a gentle whisper. He tells Elijah, "I have 7,000 prophets and people who never followed Baal. You will not be killed because your ministry has not ended. Stop trying to change Jezebel. Let her go. I'll deal with her. Return to the nation of Israel. Focus on the new responsibilities I'm giving you." The book of 1 Kings ends with Elijah's return. God prevents Jezebel from even making any further threats. Over the next years, Elijah condemns Ahab for murder. He appoints the next king over Syria and the next king of Israel. But more importantly, he calls and trains the prophet that will continue his work. Elijah's ministry had not ended. 1 Kings has a lot of Jewish history. God includes so many of the stories and details because there are lessons for us. From the story of Elijah and the widow, when he did not know who she was, he did the obvious. He talked with the first widow woman he saw. When we are not sure of God's exact direction, we should do the most obvious with the opportunity that is in front of us. From the prophets of Baal, we learn sincerity does not guarantee truth. A person can be totally sincere and be sincerely wrong. From Elijah's experience with Ahab and Jezebel, we can learn several lessons. First of all, when a nation's sin becomes greater, God's grace becomes more greatly evident. I am sure we all grieve over the sinfulness of our nation, but it does not need to leave us depressed and discouraged. God will show his grace through extraordinary ways and through extraordinary people in our day. Guaranteed, leaders and citizens alike will have ample opportunity to become aware of God and aware that they need him. Over the last few years, we have had so many weather tragedies as well as traumatic events. This is not God's judgment on our nation. God is using these things and allowing them to get people's attention to show them how much they need him. However, we need to learn a second lesson as well. Just because people have right knowledge and right facts does not guarantee they will make right choices. God does not override people's free will. He will show them their choices and consequences. He will give them a desire for his way. Then he lets each person accept or reject that information. This leads to the third lesson. Many believers have put their energy and focus into changing our nation or changing its laws. But through local elections, it is becoming evident the majority of people do not want to follow the ways of God. This means we need to change our energy and focus. There are still so many individuals who are open and searching for answers. God wants to use us to reach them and help them grow in their faith. Others of us have spent so much effort, concern, and tears over a person or situation. From Elijah's experience, we learn that if we have done all we can, and the person or situation still does not change, we must be willing to let it go. God will now handle it. We need to separate ourselves and focus on the new responsibilities, the new ministry God is giving us. When others refuse to respond to God, never let their choices keep us from being responsive to God. As long as we have life, there are ways He is still able to use us. Let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for the lessons we can learn from these stories. Thank you that no matter how bad the situation around us, your grace is always greater. Help us to know when to put our energy and focus into the life of a person or situation to bring change. But also help us to know when to let go, to put them and the situation in your hands. Protect us from despair and discouragement. Give us discernment to know how and where you want to use us. And thank you, this is possible because of Jesus. Amen.